101.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. Coming up next, Queer Voices.
This February 25th, KPFT completed its WIC fund drive. Over 3,500 KPFT listeners responded, including more than 1,500 members new to the KPFT family, pledging over $350,000. KPFT would like to thank all our listeners who made this Winterthon successful. Dedicated phone volunteers, volunteer producers and hosts, restaurants that provided delicious meals, and above all, everyone who made a pledge to keep KPFT growing, especially at this crucial time in our history. Just a friendly reminder, if you made a pledge and haven't fulfilled it yet, please send your check when you receive your form. Your timely contribution will ensure that KPFT's 33rd year will be the best ever for your community radio station. To all who helped make this drive so successful, KPFT says thank you.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbian, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
Good evening. This is Jack Fensky.
And I'm Joan Devlin.
And J.D. Doyle.
And Glenn Holt.
And I think the sun is just about down now.
Yeah, I mean, daylight savings time.
Just came out in time.
Yeah, I'm about waking up, actually.
Tonight, we have a lot of stuff going on tonight because...
Good stuff tonight.
Because it's our show. We always have lots of stuff going on. And being the first Monday of the month, we have David Elliott calling in from Washington to talk about some of the national issues. And hopefully we're talking about something other than the war. But unfortunately, the war affects everything that's going on these days.
We also have Thomas Blanton. He'll be on to talk about his new poetry book.
And you have David Mack. He's local of...
Yes.
He's representing the Human Rights Campaign Fund. He'll be talking about ENDA, which is the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. And what else is...
And the PPIA.
What is that?
It's just the Personal Partners Immigration Act.
Okay.
Permanent Partners Immigration Act.
Okay. And then in the second hour, we have...
Jim Fickey, who's going to talk about his book, Gay Warrior, which is reviewed in the Texas Triangle this week.
And who wrote that?
Jim Fickey wrote that.
No, who wrote the review?
Oh, me. And he and his co-author are going to be at the Book People in Austin at 7 p.m. on Thursday to do a signing of that book.
And also...
There's something special in the second hour, live music. We don't have that very often. Last weekend at Stages, this past weekend, they opened a new show called The Big Voice, God or Merman. And we've got the two stars in the second hour to come play and talk live.
And one of the stars knew Joan Crawford, so he's a god.
You can ask him about that.
I will.
What a coup. What a coup. High music. I bet you we beat After Hours, huh?
Yes, we sure did.
Okay. And we always got to do that. And besides that, we're going to be having segments from This Way Out, including News Wrap. And let's go right to Los Angeles for News Wrap.
I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Dean Elzinga.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending April 5th, 2003. Asia was rocked this week by the death of the man who pioneered its film portrayals of gays, openly gay pop music, and film star Leslie Cheung Kwok Wing. Cheung died in Hong Kong at age 46, apparently a suicide, leaving a note citing depression. TV and radio stations devoted hours to his work, newspapers made his death their top headline, and impromptu tributes of flowers and photos soon filled half the block outside the hotel where he'd been staying. Cheung was supportive of Chinese gay and lesbian activists, including helping to inaugurate an awards ceremony honoring media presentations of lesbian, gay, and trans issues. He's survived by his longtime partner, Daffy Tong. Cheung's music career began with a second-place finish in ATV's 1976 Asian Music Contest. By 1981, he was a star with his international hit album, The Wind Blows On. In 2000, he was honored with a Gold Needle Award from Radio Television Hong Kong for what it called his enormous contribution to Hong Kong's music industry. The news of his death led to a rush of sales of his recordings.
Chung was better known in the West for his film career, which began in 1978. His 6th films span all the genres and include work with all of Hong Kong's top directors. His breakout role came in John Woo's 1986 A Better Tomorrow. The first of his major gay film roles was in Chen Kai-jae's 1993 historical drama Farewell My Concubine, which won him top honors at the Cannes Film Festival. It was when Wong Kar-wai's 1997 gay relationship drama Happy Together proved controversial that Chung first publicly discussed his own sexual orientation. He also played a man who unwittingly falls in love with a cross-dressing woman in the comedy He's a Woman, She's a Man. Another Wong Kar-wai film, Days of Being Wild, brought Chung Best Actor honors at the 1990 Hong Kong Film Awards. This weekend's Hong Kong Film Awards were quickly reorganized to include a major tribute to Chung. His final role in Lo Chi-leung's ghost story, Inner Sense, had earned him another Best Actor nomination there.
Nor was Chung the only significant loss of an openly gay man for the dramatic arts this week. The U.S. mourned openly HIV-positive AIDS activist and character actor Michael Jeter, who died at age 50, apparently of natural causes, although he had been in good health. Jeter is best known for his television work, including his Emmy-winning supporting part in the 1990 sitcom Evening Shade and his role as the other Mr. Noodle on the children's show Sesame Street. But over a career spanning nearly 25 years, Jeter also appeared in a number of major films, including The Fisher King, The Green Mile, and most recently the upcoming The Polar Express, and on the stage where he won a Tony Award in 1990. He's survived by his life partner, Sean Blue.
Australia mourned prolific playwright and screenwriter Nick Enright, who died of melanoma at age 52. His stage script, Black Rock, was chosen Best Play of 1996 by the Australian Writers Guild, and the original screenplay for Lorenzo's Oil earned a 1993 Oscar nomination for Enright with director George Miller. His biggest stage financial success was his musical about Peter Allen, The Boy from Oz, which toured the world. He scored hits on Australian television with the award-winning Come In Spinner and the comedy Daylight Saving. And it also performed as an actor and director and touched many lives as a teacher at Australia's top acting school, NIDA, the West Australian Academy of Performing Arts, and at the Australian Theatre for Young People.
There was a great leap forward against internet censorship in South Korea as the government's Youth Protection Committee officially dropped homosexuality from its obscenity standards in response to a ruling by Korea's National Human Rights Protection Commission. The 1997 Juvenile Protection Act included statements that homosexuality is harmful and obscene, distribution of homosexual love is illegal, and homosexuality is harmful to youth, all of which the human rights body found to violate constitutional guarantees of equality, freedom of expression, and the pursuit of happiness. The commission cited international trends, and its spokesperson said that there is a growing awareness of the need to regard homosexuality as a normal sexual orientation and to protect the human rights of gays and lesbians. The advocacy groups Kirikiri and the Lesbian Gay Human Rights Federation had petitioned the commission for access for young people to sites with lesbian-gay content.
But the film of gay Michael Cunningham's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Hours, despite its numerous Oscar nominations and Best Actress win for Nicole Kidman, has had its kisses between women censored in both Malaysia and Singapore. In response to a public outcry, the chair of Singapore's Board of Film Censors, Ng Eng Ping, said in a letter in the Straits Times this week, "Our censorship guidelines are a reflection of community standards. Homosexuality is a sensitive subject in Singapore, and hence has to be treated cautiously." He added that the guidelines do not discriminate between male and female gender intimacy, but he promised that as society matures in sophistication, the classification standards will be revised to keep pace with social acceptance levels.
Gay and Lesbian Kisses this week celebrated the signing into law of sweeping new anti-discrimination and anti-vilification protections in the Australian state of Queensland. Local couples gathered on the steps of the state parliament building to hug and smooch in what student activist Chris Robb called a peaceful action and demonstration and celebration showing that what the government has delivered to us here is actually the God-given right for us to be able to show our affection. The new law also protects transgenders and extends legal recognition equal to married couples under more than 50 state laws to cohabitants of at least 2 years' standing.
In the U.S. this week, the Hawaii State House of Representatives approved by a nearly 5-to-1 margin the addition of actual or perceived gender identity to the category protected under the state's hate crimes law, which already included sexual orientation. The Senate had already passed the bill, so it moves now to Governor Linda Lingle, who is expected to sign it into law.
But both houses of Minnesota's state legislature this week approved union contracts with the state's civil servants only after specifically deleting spousal health benefits for same-gender partners. Moves in each house to reinstate those benefits failed, despite emotional pleas from supporters, including openly lesbian state Senator Karen Clark and openly gay state Representative Scott Dibble.
And in a dramatic tie vote broken by Vice Mayor Howard Gentry, Nashville, Tennessee's Metro Council this week rejected a bill to prohibit sexual orientation discrimination in the city's own employment practices. Previously, the council had given landslide preliminary approval to a stronger measure against job discrimination by all local employers. But that bill was withdrawn by its sponsor in the face of powerful religious opposition. That included a threat by the nation's largest denomination, the Southern Baptists, to move its scheduled 2005 national meeting out of Nashville.
A committee appointed by the Archbishop of South Africa's 10 million member Anglican Church this week issued a preliminary report intended lesbian marriages, including dialogue with groups outside the church. The committee has been meeting for about 6 months following a synod vote calling for clarification on the issue and a series of South African legal rulings favorable to gay and lesbian couples. The Global Anglican Church has a strong position against recognition of gay and lesbian couples. While some African leaders have claimed that homosexuality is a European phenomenon with no place in Africa, the South African Anglican Report acknowledges a history of same-gender marriages on the continent, specifically citing the tradition of the Rain Queen of the Lobito. South Africa's Lesbian and Gay Equality Project welcomed the report.
But there was no such welcome from Italy's national group, Archigay, for the glossary published this week by the Vatican's Pontifical Council for the Family. The 900-page tome is officially titled Lexicon on Ambiguous and Colloquial Terms About Family Life and Ethical Questions. Its section on homosexuality and homophobia describes homosexual orientation as rooted in unresolved psychological conflict and labels it a condition without any social value. It calls condom use for HIV prevention and exercise in self-justification. It denounces those who proclaim homosexuality normal, says their allies deny a psychological problem which makes homosexuality against the social fabric, says those who seek recognition of same-gender relationships have profoundly disordered minds, and deplores the stigmatizing of non-gays with allegations of homophobia. In short, as Archigay's honorary chair, Member of Parliament Franco Grillini, puts it, the Vatican has gone from invective to insults.
And finally, the BBC's award-winning openly gay TV talk show host Graham Norton has been named the UK's worst-dressed man by British GQ. But he also became more quickly accessible to US viewers this week and, as part of the promotion, taped a week of shows in New York City. In anticipation, Norton exclaimed, "I can't wait to get to the Big Apple. I've always been partial to a large fruit."
That's News Wrap for the week ending April 5th, 2003. Written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Dean Elzinga.
This is Queer Voices.
And it's that time of the month, the first Monday of the month. And we have David Elliott on the line to tell us what's going on in Washington. And really, there probably isn't much going on in Washington. David, is it snowing?
Well, Jack, it's not snowing here. It is up in New York City. They're getting 5 to 8 inches. The home opener of the New York Yankees was canceled. Here we've got about 40 degrees and heavy rain, and it's just East Coast icky.
So what's happening?
Well, you know, I wanted to talk to you a little bit tonight about the presidential race, because truly it is now in full swing, with a schedule of primary elections that is earlier and more compressed than ever before. We can be assured that by 1 year from now, one of the candidates currently running for president will have achieved enough momentum to claim the Democratic nomination. And for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender voters, it's pretty good news. The emerging crop of candidates is not your typical Tweedledum and Tweedledee. We have Howard Dean, who signed the historic legislation approving civil unions in Vermont. We have Joe Lieberman, who recently endorsed domestic partner benefits for partners of lesbian and gay employees in the workplace, and who recently hinted that he might be prepared to support civil unions. And we have John Kerry, the senator from Massachusetts, who had close to a perfect record on issues important to the LGBT community. And you know, Kerry, you might recall, was the only member of the U.S. Senate who was up for re-election in 1996 to vote against the Anti-Gay Defense of Marriage Act. Other serious contenders in the 2004 presidential sweepstakes: Dick Gephardt, Senator John Edwards of North Carolina, Florida Senator Bob Graham. Each of them has pretty good records on LGBT issues. With LGBT voters making up about 10% of the Democratic primary electorate, each of these presidential candidates is scrambling wildly for the distinction of being more pro-LGBT than other candidates. Why is this? Well, you do the math. Especially in the early primary states, with so many candidates in the field, it's only going to take about 30% of the vote to win any given contest. This means that if a candidate could capture all of the LGBT votes, he or she would be one-third of the way to being proclaimed the early frontrunner. Unfortunately for these candidates, it's not going to be this easy. Because so many of the top-tier candidates have similar positions, it appears as if LGBT voters will have to turn to other issues to help decide who their first choice is. And it could very well be that their first choice is going to be the candidate who does the best job of offering a dynamic, progressive vision, an alternative to President George W. Bush. And that leads me back to John Kerry, because Kerry could well be on the verge of breaking away from the rest of the Democratic pack. You know, while recently campaigning in New Hampshire, Kerry offered a very strong challenge to George W., calling for, quote, regime change in the United States. With a dig at Bush's previous lack of foreign policy experience, Kerry said he would usher in a new U.S. foreign policy if he stood before the United Nations as president. He said, and I quote, "I believe we can have a golden age of American diplomacy, but it will take a new president who is prepared to lead and who has, frankly, a little more experience than visiting the sum total of two countries before taking office."
Well, isn't he adding the third country today?
You mean Ireland, right?
Right.
Right. Well, you know, Kerry also took a dig at Attorney General John Ashcroft, and, you know, this should be of interest to LGBT voters. He said, quote, "One of the reasons why I am running for president of the United States is that I look forward with pleasure and zeal for the opportunity to appoint an attorney general of the United States who believes and reads and abides by the U.S. Constitution." And you know, Jack, in closing here, the reason that I'm mentioning John Kerry to you tonight is that as soon as he started making these remarks, he came under fire from Republicans who accused him of being anti-patriotic for daring to criticize an incumbent president during a time of war. And his response to that was that Republicans, quote, "picked the wrong guy to push around." He said, "If I'm prepared to fight back, and I am, then let them come at me." And it could be that this sort of feistiness is what Democratic voters might be looking for in 2004. And in saying all this, you know, I have to point out to you, you know, I'm not endorsing John Kerry. You know, that's not the purpose of this radio show, to endorse anybody. But he's probably going to be somebody that voters are going to want to take a look at when we make our crucial choices.
Well, and sort of talking about some of these issues, and, you know, we try not to get too much into the war because every other show it seems to be focusing on that. But are there GOP groups, you know, a lot of us are, well, Are there LGBT groups out there protesting?
Absolutely. And, you know, we talked about this a little bit last month. There is the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force. There is the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission. There are some youth groups that are strongly, youth LGBT groups that are strongly opposed to the war. In fact, if I were to run down a list of 25 or 30 LGBT groups, national ones, you'd probably find that about half of them have taken positions against the war, and the only ones that haven't are, you know, groups whose missions really, because they're so focused on one single thing, really preclude them from taking a position. And, you know, obviously the Log Cabin Republicans have not officially taken a position, but in their statements to the media, they've been supportive of the president. And then, you know, obviously you've got a human rights campaign that, you know, hews very closely to its mission, and they're not going to come out with a statement on the war. You know, neither is groups like GLSEN or GLAAD. But the progressive LGBT groups certainly have taken a position, and they're out in the streets demonstrating.
Well, I think what's even probably more important, that a lot of these groups are so much concerned about social services that, you know, here in Texas we have a $10 billion budget gap. And it was really interesting reading the Chronicle, of all places, in the Chronicle editorial, you know, if they cut back like $1 for certain services, that means that the state is probably going to lose $3 worth of services, because the federal government matches a lot of social services that the state provides. So in consequence, so they save a dollar, they end up actually, you know, the community loses $3, and then we end up paying it for higher in rates like emergency rooms.
Well, it's certainly correct. What we're seeing right now is a huge transference, an unprecedented transference from the federal government to the state governments when it comes to meeting responsibilities for social spending. And, Jack, it's only going to get worse. I don't know if you saw these figures toward the end of last week, but the unemployment rate for the month of March hit 5.8%. More than 2 million people have now lost their jobs in this country since George W. Bush took office. During the last week alone, and I'm a little bit shaky on my figures here, but during the last week alone, I think the figure was something like 225,000 new people applied for unemployment benefits. The statistics are mind-boggling. And there was even a post on a story on the front page of the Washington Post a couple of days ago suggesting that, to put it bluntly, unless George W. turns the economy around in the next 3 to 6 months, he's toast.
Well, but his approval rate's like in the 70% right now, which is really scary.
Well, you know, that's true, but look at the previous president.
Well, I don't want to bank on that.
Right. But, you know, at the end of the day, and I don't really, frankly, I don't really agree with this. I don't like this. But at the end of the day, voters in the U.S. vote their pocketbooks. Except for New England, voters do not vote foreign policy. They don't base their decisions based on foreign policy. So, you know, we're going to have to address economic conditions in this country, or guess what? In November 2004, we're going to elect a new president.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. So anything else going on up in Washington?
Well, you know, they've got their war on, and, you know, the Post is publishing a special section every single day. You know, you got your A section, you got your Metro section, you got your Style section, and now, believe it or not, every single day you got your War on Iraq section.
And so does New York Times.
Right. And so, you know, Jack, it's really, and it makes it difficult to prepare for Queer Voices every month, because it is as if all of the oxygen has been taken out of our politics, and we can't explore new issues and talk about new trends, because it's all war, and it's all war all the time. And don't get me wrong here, because, you know, when somebody invades a foreign country as we did, then we probably should be talking about this one issue and why we did it and whether or not it's right or not. But it does kind of zap the energy out of good, lively discussions of LGBT political affairs and current trends and developments.
Interesting. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Just like, well, you know, we have an all-new 24-hour cable news channel, which is owned by BLO and Time Warner, and it's not too bad, but even they're doing the weather for Iraq. You know, it's like they're supposed to be local.
Right, and it's very frustrating. You know, I make it a point to watch the network news every evening because I want to see how they're covering things, and it just gets old and tiresome to not, you know, be able to find out what's going on in your local community. You know, we had a tragic murder here in Washington, D.C. Sunday morning. Three restaurant employees killed as part of a robbery. And, you know, it just barely made the papers.
Mm-hmm. Well, David, thank you very much for joining us. David Elliott is on almost every first Monday of the month. And your of course, your full-time issue is...
Well, it's the death penalty. My group is the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. People can check out our website at www.ncadp.org. And Jack, thank you very much for having me on. And I just want to say hello to all of the listeners of Queer Voices.
Yes, well, thank you very much. We appreciate you being on every month. You're listening to Queer Voices.
I live out in suburbia. Cookie-cutter houses, cookie-cutter lives, go not inside. My split level's like all the rest. Grass mowed, two-car garage, flagstone walk, fresh paint. But I can guarantee you if the neighbors knew the truth, half of them would cut me dead, the other half would faint. Who would think to look at me, conservative as I am, that in my little tract house, happiness is just a thing called Sam. After all, in 1967, attitudes are changing, but not that fast. Secrets aren't easy, keeping them is stressful. Still, the thrill has helped make our partnership successful. We've chosen a lifestyle, husband and wife style. Well, it works for Sam and me. It's life on a tightrope, exposure seems to hover. Feels like nearly every week we almost blow our cover. But somehow the tension gives love a new dimension. Well, it works for Sam and me. I go to work, Sam cleans and cooks. That's our deal and it works out great. I'm a stickler for how things look, so when the boss comes to dinner, Sam plays it straight. Sam's pals popping off in their gaudy and their reckless. If pearls are caused by irritation, I should be a necklace. No, no, why on earth it should feel like it's worth it, but it works for Sam and me. I say, Sam, please, the caftans, the bitchery, can't they tone it down a little? Hey, they're family, Sam says. Some family. Talk about your crazy aunties and funny uncles. The mailman snoops, the neighbors peek, but we keep the curtains drawn. My mom and dad would really freak if they ever figured out what's going on. Hey, don't rush to judgment, don't call our choices tragic. We may be in the closet, but the chemistry is magic. For us, it's the right life, a wild kick at nightlife. That's the kicker, you see. In spite of all the fits I've pitched, the course of true love can't be switched. Though I'm bothered, bewildered, bedeviled to a degree, I'm still bewitched. And it works for Samantha and me.
Oh, shut up, Durwood. Mortal. And he's not even the original one.
That was Sam and Me from the soundtrack, Act Two, actually, the soundtrack of When Pigs Fly, sort of an off Broadway production.
Queer Voices.
Hi, I'm Joan Devlin, and do we have two poets in the house tonight? Yes, because I'm seeing poems by Howard Michael over here, and then also we have Thomas Blanton. Now, Thomas, I knew you when. what have you been doing lately? I see you have a new book out.
Well, putting the book together for one thing. Mainly just working on that, working on my full-time job, because I actually have one of those too, and also I've started writing for Outsmart and doing some contributing for them.
That's great. But the triangle still rules. Are you listening, Nancy? Okay. Nancy gets mad if I don't put the triangle in there when somebody says Outsmart her voice, so.
I understand.
Okay. And Howard, tell us a little bit about yourself and about your poetry.
Well, I'm not sure what to say. I am I'm a doctor. I'm a physician in private practice here in Houston. And about 11 or 12 years ago, I went through what I describe as change of lifestyle. I divorced and I came out and I started writing poetry. The trigger was unrequited love, as it so often is. And I've branched out into other subjects, and I started out writing sonnets and branched out from that too. And here I am.
Now, Thomas, you seem like you've gotten a little bit more hardcore in this new book. I've been reading it a little bit through it. I'll be reviewing it. And, you know, there's some anger here, Thomas.
There's a little bit of anger there. Part of it, I guess, was just evolution in general. The last chapbook that I put out that you've read, Letters from My Analyst.
That was a little bit more lighthearted, it seemed
like. A little more lighthearted. It was... play more in terms of comedic ideas and looking at things from just kind of trying to find the funny bits and just kind of life in general. And just through various things that I've been going through lately and just changes in subject, I've just been getting a little angrier and trying to kind of express that and kind of, I don't know, point out wrongs that should be righted and things along those nature.
Now, Howard, what kind of things do you write about? Or you said unrequited love. Are there some other themes in there?
Oh, yes. Sex.
Oh, that's a
life
good one.
In general.
Everybody likes that
life
one.
Life in general. I know. You've heard my poetry. Maybe you could categorize it better than I can. Maybe sometimes it's easier from the outside.
A lot of satire.
Yeah, I do funny stuff, or I mean it to be funny.
Why don't you go ahead and read us a selection from your book? And
who are you talking to now?
Both of you, but we'll start with you, Howard.
Okay.
And I can't see the title of your book.
Okay. This book is Wine from Sour Grapes.
Oh, that's a great title.
And it is available at Lobo. And this poem is called Hair. I hate a hair in my throat. I choke and I gag, and getting it out is just as bad as leaving it. I cough and hawk and scrape with my finger. I swallow convulsively, but ivy-like, it clings. But when I consider the silky filaments on the granite bulge of your calves, the shape of your ear and the shiver of your spine to my exploring tongue, the conflation of satin and fur that is your chest pressed to my cheek, when I savor the memory of the taste and scent of the secret you, I still hate the hair in my throat. But I love how it got there.
Very good. Everybody in the audience, in the studio, is kind of nodding. Yeah. Okay, Thomas, your turn.
This one is be out of the new book, which will be hopefully out next week, middle to end of next week, and be at Lobo, of course, and hopefully Braz's bookstore. And this is called Minority Personality Disorder. Why do you try to talk like a gay man or a black chick? Call me girl. Like a gay man or a black chick and girl. You know, I'd go out with you if you like girls. Girl, honey, you're not a gay man and you're not a black chick. Now, you made all the words to I'm every woman and swing your neck like a wrecking ball, and you do have a backside that could derail a train, but legendary or Nubian goddess, not so much. You're a little white girl with a double D chest and a press-on smile from Arkansas. And I tried to be your friend. I spent hours bearing witness to your psychoanalytically induced meditational mantra of madness. Breathe in. I am a strong, independent woman. Breathe out. Why doesn't he love me? Unleashing a banshee bray so loud and fallophilial that Gloria Steinem and Chaka Khan want to kick your ass. Because you don't know who you are. Because you don't like who you are, but you want to be different. You want to be elite. You want to re-impress all the boys who bounced you to the gutter, rented and dented, who only asked you out because they couldn't see the psycho for the breasts. And you wonder why they all went away as you aim your Fender at my forehead and put your foot through the floorboard, coming to the delusion that the only man in your life left standing must be the other woman, honey. As momentarily fascinating as it might be to consider for a second the remotest possibility of a world where any tiger you target takes one look at me and comes out like a stain at the dry cleaners, I know who I am. And I know how I'm seen, and I consciously choose to amalgamate the views and accept them. While you waste time and brain cells wallowing in the subculture of your own creation, comparing yourself to angst-addled alternativas whose first names always seem to end in I, adopting their personalities as if you didn't have enough already. I am so Ani. I am so Tori. I am so sick of your sob story, Brittany. You're not oppressed. You're not Foxy Brown. You're not a diva. You're not a sister. You are not all that in a bottle of poppers. Trying to be a gay man or a black chick before somebody sees you embezzling the image, drops a house on you, and steals your shoes, crumbling you. Like the cracker you are, because honey, gay men and black chicks have better things to do than be walk-ons in your minstrel show.
Whoa. That was great. I was like, I heard something in the studio. I'm like, applause? So your book will be out next week.
Hopefully next week.
What was kind of the driving force behind this? I mean, like I said, it is very different from letters to my analyst. Like,
a lot of it I just had to do with just kind of coming to terms with honesty in a lot of ways, and as opposed to trying to, you know, hit a punchline or find a funny one-liner and create something that the audience could laugh at, trying to just find things that I am angry about and things that I do express an opinion on, and just expressing anger through trying to create a point that way. Mm-hmm. There's still lots of funny in there. It's just lots of anger too.
How about you, Howard? How do you see your work evolving as time goes on?
It's evolving. It's moving from form to free verse. It's I think I'm proving that I'm telling less and showing more. Mm-hmm. My subject matter ranges very widely, and I and my mood in the poems range. I think I've got a very large range of mood.
Now, Thomas, I know you've done poetry readings and shows. Mm-hmm. And plans to do more of those in the future?
Actually, yeah, we have. Howard and I will both be in a reading this weekend, Friday, at the New Gay and Lesbian Community Center. It's sort of featuring Howard. He'll be a spotlight. And then we have about 7 or 8 poets lined up in open mic afterwards. And then long-term, a poet named Sarah Crowder and I will be putting together a show, a two-person show called Dating Monsters, which we're hoping to premiere in October.
Oh, great. So it sounds like you guys are going to be very busy now. Howard, you're doing that show at the community center. Do you have any other plans to do more shows down the road, or just kind of take it as it comes?
I take it as it comes, yeah.
And what time might that be?
Friday at 8 o'clock.
Okay, and the community center is at 3400 Montrose, Suite 207.
That is correct. Same building as Sky Bar, next to Disco Kroger's.
Right, and so... Howard, your book is...
This book is...
Poems by Howard Michael.
Wine from Sour Grapes.
Great. And we won't say Thomas's yet on the air, but it's called Preaching and Something, Poems and Other Fun from Thomas Blanton. That'll be available here in the next week or so. Mm-hmm. And if you'll both leave us with one more poem, and then we will go on to our next guest. And you've been listening to Queer Voices. We are talking to Howard Michael and Thomas Blanton, poets.
Okay, this is... a very different style. This is a sonnet, Will-o'-the-Wisp. With emerald glow, scent of leaf and mold, the forest drew me in and seemed to say that what I caught was mine to have and hold. Heeding, I left the open public way to run in private joy beneath the trees, tracking a glitter rather sensed than seen that danced in air like drunken bumblebees darting between the stands of brown and green. But that was hours ago. Now emeralds black with night, no longer light of heart or foot, I look behind and see there's no way back. So tripping over deadfall rock and root, I stumble on, chasing that feral spark, the mythic light that glimmers in the dark.
Thomas Blanton.
This is called The Warning Signs. I love you. But I'm not in love with you. I've never cheated on anyone, except for this one time. I'm a really good liar. I just want you to be happy. We're just roommates. It's just a urinary tract infection. Just so you know, I'm kind of seeing this girl. You're gayer than I am. You're getting chunky. If you get in shape, you'll be perfect and you'll leave me. Has anyone ever told you that you look like Ray Romano? I think the Jews are trying to take over Hollywood. I'm a straight ticket Republican. My parents are visiting. I'm moving in with my parents. My parents are moving in. My mother wants to fix me up with her hairdresser, but don't worry. I'll tell him all about you. I don't like your friends, except for the hot ones. You sound just like my ex. I miss him so much. My girlfriend thinks you're cute, so I was wondering. I'm not really getting anything out of this. I'm not an alcoholic. I just drink to escape. Do you have any porn? I never break up with people. I just stop calling. I'll call. I'll call. I'll call. I'll call. I love you for your mind. And that's it.
Great. You're listening to Queer Voices.
With a new Now and Again feature, This Way Out's Steve Pride previews a couple of queer films that are coming out on video.
The New Women is a black and white sci-fi send-up from out director Todd Hughes and writer P. David Ebersole.
We are the new women, working together.
This is Todd Hughes. I'm the writer and director of a new feature film called The New Women, which stars Mary Warrenoff, Amy Hill, Jenny Shimizu, Cheryl Dunier, and a cast of over 100 women. The New Women is basically about women taking over the world. What we do is set up the sexual politics in a small town where women clearly haven't come a long way, baby. And then a mysterious rainstorm comes along and literally puts everyone in the entire world to sleep. And slowly but surely, the women start waking up, but the men never do. So women sort of have it upon themselves to rebuild society.
Come to order, people, please. We've got to have order. Ladies, I've got to have some organization here. Now, I want to suggest that we nominate certain women to fill the roles that their husbands played in town. You know, just as figureheads to kind of get things organized for the time being.
Great. Does that mean I get to be a lazy bum while my husband sleeps?
The men do get erections every 45 minutes, which adds to the complications. But Mary Warrenoff plays this meek housewife who sort of overcomes her low self-esteem and leads a group of women in search of this place called Elysium, which is supposed to be a female utopia they hear about on the radio.
Sordid Lives from outwriter-director Del Shores is a campy, queer, white trash comedy with an incredible cast, including Olivia Newton-John as a lesbian country singer and Leslie Jordan as a Tammy Wynette impersonating drag queen.
Now who's to judge? Who's a saint and who's a sinner?
You're my 27th therapist in the last 3 years.
Lord, it's tough enough to trudge from brunch to dinner.
I'm from the South. Texas, actually.
We seek the light of truth between our white lies.
I was raised rigid Southern Baptist. I'm an actor, and I'm gay.
We sleep away our youth under tattletale skies.
Now you know I've needed a seventh therapist.
Who's a sinner? Who's a saint? Who's to say who you can love and who you can't?
I'm Del Shores. I'm the director and writer of Sordid Lives, sort of a bizarre coming out story coupled with a dysfunctional Texas family, and lots of little stories, very Altman-esque in that way, that lots of stories are come out of an event that happens before the movie starts.
Well, I tell you one thing, I sure as hell wouldn't have quit smoking if I had known my sister was going to die. 3 days now, I am about to die myself.
Peggy Ingram has died this scandalous death. She's this wonderful Baptist woman in town, 70 years old. She was having an affair with Beau Bridges' character, G.W. Nethercott, who has prosthetic legs. They're in a motel room. She gets up to go to the bathroom. She trips on the legs because she didn't turn on a light. She hits her head on the sink and dies of a subdural hematoma. And then all hell breaks loose in a town. Delta Burke plays his wife, who is just humiliated beyond belief. Takes a little volume and gets liquored up and gets a gun.
Betsy, have you ever had an affair with anybody with missing limbs or anything?
Not that I can remember, Juanita.
I once had an affair with a man with only one testicle.
Hi, everyone. I'm Olivia Newton-John, and in this movie, Sordid Lives, I play a white trash country singer called Betsy Mae Harling. And she was a friend of the woman who dies in the movie, and her character is just a lot. Well, you'll see. You'll see.
Sorry, little. Sorry, little.
real good, Bitsy.
Thank you, Juanita.
Also this month, don't miss two great foreign language films from Strand Releasing. Lan Yu is a moody gay romance, filmed entirely in secret in China. And from Italy comes His Secret Life, a brilliantly nuanced story of a man who's the wife and a male lover. These are just a few of the new gay films that are out on video. If you can't find these films locally, they can be ordered from any number of online sources. A few that are gay-owned and operated are StrandREL.com, WolfVideo.com, that's Wolf ending in an E, and TLAVideo.com. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Spring is here and my domestic partner is too. Whoa, whoa, whoa. We'll put a sign that says just married on our Subaru. We'll say I can't because we can't say I do. At a wedding ceremony worth manure. You say we're going to the chapel, but we cannot get married. From Vermont to Minneapolis, no, we cannot get married. Gee, I really love you, but we cannot get married. Locked out of the chapel of love. Bells may ring and the sun may shine. Whoa, whoa, whoa. The 1,000 tax breaks will never be mine, no. And when I hold you close in half the states, it's a crime. Don't confuse matrimony and love. Don't ask, don't tell an apple, it's you wanna get married. It's rabbinical and papalish to keep us from getting married. Gee, I really love you, but we cannot get married. Locked out of the chapel of love. Down in the Big Apple, no, we cannot get married. Clearly nowhere on the map will let us legally get married. Gee, I really love you, but we still cannot get married. Locked out of the chapel of love. Whoa, 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 whoa. Until people grapple with
this is Queer Voices.
I love to be queer.
Chris Ho is an outspoken critic who loves to trash his native Singapore, which he argues is a construct, not a country. He's managed to become one of Singapore's most popular celebrities, despite the fact that the rich city-state is also known as a repressed society that likes to stifle political dissent and free speech. Its one-party government keeps a tight rein on the island's 4 million citizens, and sex, let alone being gay or lesbian, is not something that's officially talked about. Yet, Ho has managed to survive as a counterculture pop rebel, singer, and writer who happens to be gay. He's also the author of a new book. With production assistance from Paul Jaffe, This Way Out's Brian Goble reports from Singapore.
I think there are people who would like a different voice, an alternative voice, so to speak, and I guess I've become the alternative voice.
Singapore, you are not my country. Singapore, you are not a country at all.
He is a Singapore celebrity, DJ, pop columnist, gadfly, and occasional singer. Chris Ho's counterculture satire and rants against the government, media, and people of Singapore have earned the title of Singapore's official griper.
I come across, I realize, in a very naggy tone, and I justify that in that Singapore is known as a nanny state to the rest of the world, and we are a nanny state because we pride ourselves with being very paternalistic.
Ho, who's also known as X-Ho, doesn't seem at all like a loudmouth pop culture rebel on the cover of his CDs and books. He did start Singapore's first punk rock band, and he still looks like a punk rocker. His body is covered in a blanket of tattoos, one for each time he visits Thailand, his ultimate destiny. A dance track off his CD, X with an X, Me All Good No Bad, celebrates his three T's to success, a takeoff on the Prime Minister's three T's to success.
Our PM outlines the three T's for Singapore's future success. Technology, trade, and tribes. The last of these refers to possessing a national identity. I, too, have the three T's for success.
For me, like, even though I'm a DJ and so-called musician as well and a columnist, everything, it's really from the point of view of being a music fan. I'm not a career as DJ, I'm not a career as writer, even though I've written two books, and I don't really consider myself like author, you know. It's all pretty rock and roll inspired, if you ask me.
Ho's new book, which is a collection of his essays and columns, is titled Attack of the SM Space Encroachers.
There's a play on the acronym SM. In its actual context of the book, SM means Sung Wei, and that's a local dialect term for sour grape. So it's really a title that says Attack of the Sour Grape Space Encroachers. The first part of the book is primarily about Singaporeans who are space encroachers because they can't wait to elbow their space back. It's almost like getting back on the sly because it's a repressed society, basically.
Would you mind reading a portion of the book for us?
This is a poem I wrote called To Die for One's Country. Am I willing to die for my country? I know what Julie Burchill would say. Yes, I'm more than willing to die for my country, a country where I was born, where I've lived all my life, if just for the inexplicable connection well beyond me, a spiritual bond written in the stars. Yes, I'm willing to die for my country, but not when it's run by the unloving and patronizing, abusing our soul as ass's fuel for absolute power, immoderate control, and the devil's buck. Loading our gains like a Nazi death truck anytime a new experiment takes its fancy. To die for such a one is a folly. How does one sacrifice one's life without passion? How to have passion when there's no real love? We're still pining for just 3% of it from above. We're not even children of a one-choice nation. We're pawns in the upgrading empire, in the words of the poet Elfian. Go send your eloquent messengers, the happy and hostage press, but our hearts understand what we get to say much less. Oh, don't forget, we're mouthless, prosperous, well-fed, and free. So why ask that question, unless it's reference to a soldier's duty? The text is clear for all who choose to see. The guilty's masking guilt whilst hiding the key. And by the way, here's a footnote. Come to think of it, Julie won't bother. She'll understand the stupidity of knocking one's head against the wall or speaking to the self-righteously deaf on a big money mission that will manufacture love if required. Besides, she writes for The Guardian, not The Nanny.
Chris Ho reading from his new book, Attack of the SM Space Encroachers. Ho's written and spoken tirades against the Singapore government are so biting, it's hard to believe his citizenship hasn't been yanked. Singapore's laws gained worldwide notoriety. Its temporary visa warns in bold red letters that there will be death to all drug traffickers. In the midst of all this repression, however, seems to be a growing tolerance for gays and lesbians. The shopping malls are teeming with gay men. One Asian newspaper even called Singapore Asia's gayest city. I asked Ho what it's like to be a gay Singaporean.
I can be outed. There's no such thing as a gay Singaporean. You know the kind of repression we have in Singapore? You won't believe. Although we have seven gay saunas now, but to me that's got everything to do with a pink dollar. It's not about acceptance of one's sexuality. So no, I'm not gay to begin with. Can I just say? What's it like? Sorry.
Yeah. What's it like?
I would imagine, I think, pretty tough because it's a very repressive society and you have to watch your back all the time. There used to be a lot of raids. In fact, in the previous book, I wrote a whole chapter about this undercover cop. He arrested this fishball seller for fondling his crotch. And so because of that, I came all out and I told Singaporeans not to touch another Singaporean. You never know if he's undercover.
The Singapore does have a sodomy law, right?
Oh, yeah, and not only sodomy law, it's also, oral sex is also a crime, even between heterosexual couples, unless they are legally married. Don't be surprised, it's true, I didn't make this up.
Are you ready for something that's been floating around on the internet? Here are the top 10 reasons why there are no sex scandals in Singapore. Number 10. You can't even be naked in your own home. So how to have sex?
Singapore is all about being able to prosecute you if they want to. That's what it's all about.
The cops are bullies?
No, not the cops. They're just doing their job. I think our big brother is a big bully.
Where are the police? I don't see them.
In that sense, our society is really effective. It's come to a stage whereby I think everything runs on its own accord now, according to how Big Brother envisioned it in the beginning. So everything is running as according to plan. The only little implosions here and there, for instance, one is we don't have future leaders because all the dynamic people seem to either have run away or they have cowered to the back. Nobody is interested in politics. So we've actually got this new creativity campaign going on to encourage people to be dynamic and creative.
And drum roll, please. The number one reason why there are no sex scandals in Singapore. We are still confused over condoms and condos, leh.
For all his criticisms of the government and people, the artist known as X-Ho might not exist without the Singapore he loves to trash. I asked him if he'd ever consider leaving.
I've also talked about leaving for a long time, so I'm gearing myself up to go one of these days. Like I said on stage a while ago when I read that piece I wrote, I want to be Thai. There's no other option for me but Thailand. There's something about Thailand. It's the culture in that there are a lot of things about Thailand that's very antithetical to the whole Singapore society. For instance, Thailand thrives on chaos. They find a kind of order through chaos, and we don't trust that kind of chaos. Our society is completely regimented, completely, in every step of the way. From how many kids you have to the number of bottles of liquor you can bring from the airport. Everything is regimented. In that sense, we're the complete opposite. So it's pretty understandable that a lot of Singaporeans actually look to Thailand as their escape. Thailand is like the Mexico to Americans, you know. Chaos. But fun.
I, too, have the 3 T's for success. Temple, tattoos, and Thailand.
For This Way Out, I'm Brian Goble in Singapore.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Dean Elzinga, Graham Underhill, Fenceberry, Lex Walkner, Steve Pride, and Brian Goble contributed program material. Thanks also to Paul Jaffe. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen to This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through direct charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. To find out how you can help keep This Way Out on the air and get some queer audio history and timeless music in the bargain, please visit our website at thiswayout.org, email us at tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on WHRW Bing to New York, 2BLU Katoomba, New South Wales, KBOO Portland, Oregon, and more than 135 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. And we'll continue to stay tuned.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Valensky, Joan Devlin, and Glenn Holt.
This is the BBC World Service with Sally Aykroyd and Anu Anand.
The Pentagon says American forces have bombed a residential neighborhood in Baghdad to target Iraqi leaders.
In Basra, British troops patrolling the old city for the first time receive a mixed welcome.
We don't need water and food. We need peace and quiet. Especially at night, we want to sleep quietly, especially for those children.
In northern Iraq, Kurdish fighters and American special forces are moving steadily closer to the important towns of Mosul and Kirkuk.
But even with large parts of the country under American and British control, the bloodiest battles yet may be fought in the Sunni heartland.
We'll also be reporting on how American companies are coping with global opposition to the war. But first, let's have all the latest developments in detail.
BBC News with Zainab Ahmed. American commanders say their forces will stay in the center of Baghdad after tanks penetrated the heart of the city on Monday, occupying an area dominated by Iraqi government buildings on the west bank of the River Tigris. Within the last hour, reports from Baghdad said heavy machine gun fire and explosions could be heard near the center of the city. Brigadier General Vince Brooks at Central Command in Qatar said that U.S. troops are now free to move around the Iraqi capital at will.
They'll make the decisions on what parts of Baghdad they wish to obtain control of, whether they want to move to a different location, or simply go directly to where they happen to have intelligence on where any regime forces might be located.
And in the past few minutes, officials at the Pentagon in Washington say American forces have bombed a residential neighborhood in Baghdad after receiving intelligence that members of the Iraqi leadership, including President Saddam Hussein, may have been there. The Americans say they now control all major access roads around Baghdad. On the outskirts of the capital, advancing U.S. Marines battled with Republican guards defending bridges to the east, and there were also reports of fighting in the northwestern suburbs. A BBC correspondent with American forces there says many Iraqi tanks have been destroyed or abandoned by their crews. He's also seen several civilians killed in the fighting and filmed a group of men, women and children cowering by the roadside with their hands raised. Many others tried to escape the shooting by holding white flags. Hospital doctors in Baghdad say they've been overwhelmed by the number of casualties of the fighting, both military and civilian. A BBC correspondent in the city said surgeons are exhausted, drugs are running out, and surgery is being performed without anesthetics. A spokesman for the Red Cross in the Iraqi capital, Roland Hugonim Benjamin, said hospital staff were being stretched to breaking point.
The hospitals are, of course, doing whatever they can. People are extremely dedicated. Surgeons are working round the clock. Of course, you get exhausted when you're there for too long. We certainly hope that they will be able to keep going for as long as it is needed.
Among those killed during Monday's American incursion into Baghdad were at least 14 residents of a district west of the center of the capital whose homes were destroyed by a huge explosion. A reporter who visited the district said the houses and the families living in them were obliterated by an enormous blast, which left a crater some 50 meters wide. You're listening to the news from the BBC in London. British military commanders say they'll restore order quickly to Iraq's second city, Basra, where the capitulation of Iraqi regular forces has been followed by widespread looting. Residents of Basra have stripped official buildings of computers and furniture. One reporter saw a hotel's grand piano being pushed down the street. The looting took place as British soldiers consolidated their hold on Basra. After days of heavy artillery battles on the outskirts, paratroopers walked virtually unchallenged into the old part of the city. The commander of UK forces in Iraq, Air Marshal Brian Burridge, stressed that his was a mission of liberation, not occupation.
The last 48 hours have been historic for the people of Basra. After decades under the heel of Saddam's brutal regime, UK forces are in the process of delivering liberation to the people of Basra.
President Bush is in Northern Ireland for talks with the British Prime Minister Tony Blair, which will focus on who should run Iraq after the war. John Devitt reports from Belfast.
A spokesman for Mr. Blair said the tone of the talks was informal, freewheeling, he said, covering a wide range of topics, including Iraq, Northern Ireland, the Middle East peace process, and other geopolitical issues. To illustrate his point, he said the two leaders had walked together in the gardens of Hillsborough House, where they're staying, and the atmosphere was more Camp David than Downing Street. But despite the informality and the apparently ambitious agenda, it's the future of Iraq which dominates. Mr. Blair has accepted that there will be a short transitional period when essentially the United States will be in charge, but it's unclear how power will be handed over to the Iraqi people, which is both the leaders' long-term objective.
Courts in Cuba have imposed lengthy prison sentences on more than 30 dissidents after convicting them of treason in a series of closed trials. Among them are prominent opponents of the Cuban government, including the democracy activist Héctor Palacios. BBC News.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Valensky, Joan Devlin, and Glenn Holt.
Hey!
Good evening. You're listening to Queer Voices, and I have on the phone with me F. Jim Fickey, PhD, and Gary S. Grimm, MA. So we've got both authors of Gay Warrior, Transforming Betrayal into Wisdom, on the line. And I wanted to talk to you both a little bit about that. You know, a lot of people think the term gay warrior is kind of an oxymoron. So could you kind of clarify for our audience what you are exactly talking about when you use the term gay warrior?
Well, Joan, gay warrior for us has to do with finding the deep masculine within a gay man. It doesn't have to do with war. It has to do with the personal power that